You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 143 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Three Paths to Christ, Experiencing the Supersensible. 14 lectures, translated by Christiana Bryan. This is Lecture 10, given in Cologne on the 8th of May, 1912. Entitled Prophecy and Heralding Christ's Impetus, The Spirit of Christ and Its Sheaths, A Whitsun Message. Today's talk calls for an introduction on the theme of our observations. It is, after all, the day which we in the Theosophical movement call White Lotus Day, which each year reminds us that Madame Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, now having left the physical plane, was the founder of the Theosophical movement in recent times. It will need little encouragement to adopt a tone, which is surely within every soul here present, to elicit feelings of admiration, devotion, and gratitude toward the individuality who sojourned on earth in Madame Blavatsky, and who refocused and renewed humankind's view of the ancient mysteries, from which has flowed every motivation toward and strength for spiritual development needed by human beings. Understanding and grasping the task of recent times, H.P. Blavatsky could share in popular form the mystery wisdom to which she had access, such that this popular form diverges from the ways and means, through secret channels and streams, by which mystery wisdom once percolated into human work and creating. Precisely this is the recent significance of the fact that what used to be given to the few now has to be disseminated in more general form. To be among the first to act along these lines became the mission of Madame Blavatsky. She directed human attention toward something which has indeed forever been holy to those who knew about it. That this is so will now be the starting point for today's remarks, and it will bring us nearer to our subject. The poetry of a thinker whom the mass of educated people know, or rather do not know, as a dry conceptual thinker, as a foreman, as a master builder of far, far removed forms of ideation. What this thinker supposedly only transmitted in crystalline mental constructs belied the warmest of feeling, and proved that ideas alone cannot clothe what stems from the heart. He demonstrates this in a poem addressing sacred mysteries. Hegel, who one can say is the thinker of Europe, who has become so well known to modern scholars that today many of his books remain unopened in libraries, has left us a poem written with his heart's blood. I am referring to the poem Eleusis, which will now be recited by Miss von Sievers. With this poem, we would like to pay tribute to the memory of H.P. Blavatsky. Hegel's Eleusis, dedicated to his friend Hölderlin, August 1796. Quote, around me, within me, reigns peace. The unrelenting cares of busy human beings now sleep. I am granted freedom and ease. Thanks be to you, my liberator, O night. The moon shrouds the uncertain outlines of the distant hill with a bloom of mist. The bright strip of lake glints genially across at me. The memory of the day's tedious clatter recedes, as if long years lay between it and now. Your image, dear friend, now rises before me, with the joys of days long flown. Yet soon these yield to the sweeter hope of our reunion. I paint, even now, the opening scene of our long-anticipated fiery embrace. Later, the more inward questions, the secrets, the mutual querying, to discover what, in bearing, countenance, sense, or feeling, time has since wrought upon my friend. Then the delight of certainty, on finding that faith in the old bond remains, now truer, firmer, riper than before, not sealed by any oath save by free truth alone to live, never, never to make truce with any convention that would regulate our feelings and opinions? Then does thought parley with drear reality? And that thought which lightly bore me to you over mountains and rivers announces with a sigh its discord, and with it flees that sweet dream of fantasy. My eye is raised to the eternal dome of heaven, to you, O radiant stars of night. And forgetfulness of all hopes and wishes streams down from your eternity, erasing all thought in the beholding. And what my I capital, named I capital, vanishes. I give myself up to the immeasurable. I am in it. Am everything, am it alone. But returning thoughts estrange, horrified at the endlessness and amazed, fail to grasp the depth of this beholding. Imagination brings thought closer to the eternal, marrying it with form. Welcome, you sublime beings, lofty shades, from whose brow fulfilled perfection rays. I am not daunted. I feel it also as my home, that gleam, that gravity, which around you flows. Ah, were the portals of your sanctuary now to spring open, O Ceres, you who were enthroned in Eleusis. Now drunk with exaltation, I feel the festive nearness of your presence, and would comprehend your revelations. I'd interpret the lofty sense of the images, would hear the hymns of the gods' banquets, and the sublime axioms of their council. But your halls have ceased to echo, O goddess. The circle of gods has fled to Olympus, fled from their desecrated altars, and from the tomb of profaned humanity is fled that genius of innocence who enchanted them here. The wisdom of your priests is silent. Not a note of the sacred rite is preserved for us. And in vain do they strive, those scholars, their curiosity greater than their love of wisdom. They possess the seekers, and they disdain you. To master them they dig for words, to find the graven imprint of your exalted mind in vain. Mere dust and ashes do they seize, wherein your life eternal returns never more to them. Yet even under mould and unensouled they preen themselves, the eternally dead, the self-satisfied, in vain. No sign remains of your celebrations, no trace of an image. For the sons of initiation, the abundance of majestic teachings, the depths of that ineffable feeling, are far too sacred that they should dignify it with desiccated symbols. The very thought of it seizes not the soul, which, submersed beyond time and space in intimations of infinity, forgets itself, and once again awakes to consciousness. Were any to want to tell of this to others, were they e'en to speak in angels' tongues, they'd feel the poverty of words. Recoiling in horror at the sacred being thought so small, having made it so small, that speech to them seems a sin, thus quaking, their lips they seal. That vow the initiate bade himself, a wise law forbade those poorer spirits from making known what they had seen, heard, felt throughout the sacred night. That not even the further advance themselves should be disturbed in their prayers by the clamor of their mischief. Their hollow chatter stirs to anger that holiness itself, should e'er be dragged through filth, yet be still entrusted to memory, so that never would it become a plaything, nor wares of the sophists, who would sell it for an obol coin, nor become the mantle of eloquent hypocrites, nor the cane to a mirthful youth, nor yet to become so empty in the end that only in the echo of foreign tongues would its life's roots be found. Your sons, O goddess, stinting in your honor, flaunted it not through lanes and markets, but nurtured it in their breasts' inner sanctum. Thus did you not live upon their lips, and thus did their lives honor you. In their deeds you still live on. Only tonight, holy goddess, did I hear you, and oft do the lives of your children reveal you to me. I divine you time and again as the soul of their deeds. You are the exalted signifier, the true faith in the single Godhead, who, when all else founders, does not falter. Close quote. I feel myself to be in complete harmony with the individuality of H.P. Blavatsky, especially when, if I may say, over the next few days a few words are spoken about her in clear and frank truthfulness. It was her way, when she was fully herself, to wish to be true. That is why we honor her best when we send our grateful thoughts to her and speak a few words of the purest truth. H.P. Blavatsky showed in her totality, in her individuality, what inner strength, what a strong impulse she had in relation to the spiritual movement we know as the Theosophical Movement. To underline this, one only needs to be directed to her first larger work, titled Isis Unveiled. On the average reader, this book really makes a chaotic impact, in that it goes, as it were, above and below. Yet if someone who knew that its contents represent ancient wisdom, protected in the mysteries, knowledge that has been guarded over many ages from profane view, and who also knew that this wisdom is not disseminated through external human works, but via secret societies, they will nevertheless find much chaotic material in this book, but also something else. They will also encounter for the first time a work which, staunchly and fearlessly, lays certain secrets of the mysteries bare before a profane world. Anyone who understands such things will find vast tracts that are correctly interpreted in a way that only those initiated can do. The chaotic impression remains and can be explained in terms of the following sensible observations. The outer personality of H.P. Blavatsky, to the extent that she was incarnated in her physical body, with her intellect and with her personal traits, her sympathies and antipathies, demonstrates to us, in the way titled Isis Unveiled is written, that it was utterly impossible for her, on the basis of her personality, of her soul, to produce what she gave to the world. She communicates things she herself could not possibly understand. If one follows her train of thought, it becomes proof that higher spiritual individualities made use of the body and personality of H.P. Blavatsky in order to communicate what necessarily had to flow into humanity. Just because one cannot ascribe to Blavatsky what she gave, does one have lively proof that those individualities who are with the Theosophical Movement are the masters of wisdom and the harmony of feeling, who found in her an instrument? Those who see this clearly know that matters do not issue from her, but that they flowed through her from high spiritual individualities. Today there is no time to speak of this in detail. One could raise the question, and it is often raised, why did these exalted individualities choose Madame Blavatsky as their instrument? Because she was, in fact, the most suitable. Why was one of the scholarly gentlemen who study comparative religions not chosen as this instrument? We need only focus on the most eminent and respected of experts in Oriental religious systems, the great Max Müller, and we will see why, in his own words, he could not announce what had to be communicated through the human instrument of Madame Blavatsky. He expressed a curious opinion about what Madame Blavatsky had to say about Oriental wisdom. If you encounter on a road a pig who grunts, nobody finds that remarkable. But if you encounter a human being who grunts like a pig, people find that very remarkable. It should be said, those who do not corrupt Eastern religious systems in the sense mentioned by Max Müller equate with the human who grunts like a pig. Neither do I see much logic in the comparison, for what grounds would one have to be so surprised that a pig grunts? However, when humans grunt, that is an art not everyone can master. This is a slightly lame comparison, but the fact that it could be made at all shows that the personality of Max Müller was not the appropriate one. A personality had to be chosen who was not particularly gifted intellectually, and this naturally entailed all sorts of disadvantages. In the event, Madame Blavatsky brought with her all the passionate sympathies and antipathies of her character into this great communiqué. Now she felt a strong antipathy toward those worldviews which flowed from the Old and New Testament records. She had a strong reaction against all things Hebrew and Christian. One thing, however, is essential to recognizing the ancient wisdom of humanity in its original form, and that is to face the revelations emanating from spiritual worlds with absolute symmetry of feeling. Antipathy and sympathy create a sort of fog, obscuring our inner eye, EYE. It was in this way that Madame Blavatsky felt increasingly constrained by this mist existing in her vision, and could only see with any clarity what was transmitted via the so-called purely Aryan tradition. She saw this in its spiritual depths with peculiar clarity, but became one-sided. And so it came about that in her second great work titled The Secret Doctrine, she depicted the ancient Aryan proto-religion in a biased, prejudiced way. One should not seek for the mysteries of Sinai and Golgotha among Madame Blavatsky's oeuvre, because she brought antipathy toward them. It was because of this that she was led by powers which could, with great clarity and power, endow her with anything but Christian content. You can find this in the wonderful Zion stanzas which Madame Blavatsky included in her secret doctrine. Yet through it she was forced from the path of initiation in the physical world. And this emerges through, title Isis Unveiled, if only in fragmentary rays, end quote. In the latter book, Madame Blavatsky could only portray, on account of her incomplete initiation, this one-sided stream, which was being led by a view of the world that excluded Christianity. Thus did an idiosyncratic book, The Secret Doctrine, come into being, a book in which there are the greatest revelations that humanity could, at the time, receive. It contains things that are emphasized in other books, such as the letters from the Masters of Wisdom and Harmony of Feelings, the so-called title Letters from the Masters of Wisdom. Here again you find some of the greatest things revealed to humankind. But there are other parts of the secret doctrine, such as a detailed theory of mass. It is precisely those who, from a correct understanding, value among the highest what her Zion stanzas and her master letters could convey to humanity, who also gain the impression that the long drawn-out tracts on the theory of mass issue from someone suffering from graphomania, from someone who just jotted down whatever came to them and who couldn't put their pen down. Other parts speak out of a deeply passionate nature about scientific things, yet without comprehension of any precision. Thus the secret doctrine is an intermixed assemblage of things best disconnected, yet which does contain high wisdom. It becomes understandable when one takes alongside it the remarks of one who knew Madame Blavatsky well and was highly knowledgeable. He said, Madame Blavatsky was actually a threefold being. Firstly, you encounter a small, ill-favored woman of illogical thought with a passionate character, who is always annoyed about something, yet who could be good-naturedly loving and compassionate, but definitely not what one would call a talented woman. Secondly, when wisdom would pour through her words, she was a pupil of the great masters. Then her expression and gestures would change. She became someone else, out of whom spiritual world spoke. She was also a third personality, a royal apparition, awe-inspiring, towering above her surroundings. These were the rare occasions when the masters spoke directly through her, giving tidings through her words and writings. Souls inspired with a sense of truth will always differentiate meticulously in Madame Blavatsky's works and know what is at issue. No greater service could be offered to Madame Blavatsky, to whom we turn our gaze today, than that we recognize her in light of the truth. No greater reverence could be offered her than to lead the theosophical movement in light of the truth. Clearly, at the inception of the theosophical movement, an individual direction had to be taken, but it has grown and become more significant, and it also became necessary to feed another stream into this theosophical movement. It has become essential to add to the theosophical movement what has been flowing from occult sources through Rosicrucian elements since the 14th century, and against which Madame Blavatsky was implacable. Today we have fulfilled the intentions of the theosophical movement, in that we have not only recognized the Oriental wisdom and view of the world, but have also added to them the outlook that finds expression in the revelations of Sinai and the mystery of Golgotha. Maybe especially today a question might be inferred. Does the comprehensive scope in understanding the true impetus that should be contained within the theosophical movement consist in adding to the world outlook of H.P. Blavatsky what could not be included at its inception? Or does, in quotes, comprehensive scope consist of elevating a most questionable and specialized opinion to the level of dogma, and wishing to disseminate this as that very comprehensive scope of the theosophical movement? For my part, I say unapologetically, I know that we would be dishonoring the spirit of H.P. Blavatsky, who is now in the spiritual world, were we to follow the latter course. I know that it is not to transgress against this spirit, but rather to accommodate it, if one does what it wills today, if one adds to the theosophical movement that which this spirit, while in their physical body, was not capable of adding. I also know that I am in full harmony with Madame Blavatsky in what I am telling you when I say the following. I wish for one thing, that our Western stream should be brought to bear on this theosophical movement. Some additional knowledge and certain supplementary truths have been introduced over the last few years. Let us imagine, let us really imagine, that in 50 years everything would have to be revised and corrected. Let us suppose that not a single stone of our spiritual building, in the way presented today, could remain standing upon another, that occult research would be obliged to rectify everything from the ground upward in 50 years' time. I would have to describe it only thus. That may be the case, but one thing among what we want here will remain, and it is toward this end that the prime thrust of our Occidental theosophical movement is aimed. May this be the one thing that can be said, that there was a theosophical movement which wanted nothing other in the field of Western occultism than to show to advantage what issues from the purest, most unclouded truthfulness. Our aim is that this can be said. It is better not to say dubious things at all than that people should somehow deflect from that which, in the purest sense of the truth, we can stand for, responsibly, in the face of spiritual powers. There may be other upshots from this, namely that someone may feel called upon to object, why do you reject this or that issue, as it appears in the theosophical movement? That is hardly tolerant. Others may associate tolerance with differing concepts. But we use concepts such that we feel obliged to protect humanity from anything that cannot stand the test of unalloyed truthfulness. Some may distort what we do, but we will not give ground. We will try to fulfill our task to the point where we reject everything that needs to be rejected, while serving what has just been said. Then, but only then, when something causes our sense of truth to be in disharmony with it, only then can we reject it. We do not recognize any other reasons nor feelings. We will not get involved in trivial turns of phrase and talk of opinions being of equal value, of brotherliness, and so on, because we will know that even love among human beings can only flourish when it is truthful and sincere. Let this wish to be ensouled by truth, permeated by a pure sense of truthfulness, be the expression of this festive day. Because a new feature has been added today, more has come to light that can serve as a contribution toward explaining the mysteries of the universe. These things are not said to denigrate in any way other great cultural or religious movements among humankind, nor to compare one with another. How often has it been mentioned that when we look back to the first post-Atlantean epoch with its spiritual culture of the holy rishis, there was, during that first period, a culture of loftier spirituality than all that followed. Just as little does it occur to us to disparage Buddhism. Rather do we highlight its virtues, knowing that it has endowed humanity with qualities which Christianity will only in future have to attain. Yet it is immensely important that we repeatedly point to the differences that exist between Eastern and Western cultures. Eastern culture speaks only of individuals who have, over many incarnations, undergone advancement. Oriental culture speaks, for instance, of bodhisattvas as individualities who have completed their human development more quickly than others. However, they focus on the individuality who goes from incarnation to incarnation, and that, in a particular incarnation, that bodhisattva attains Buddhahood. When such a bodhisattva has become a Buddha, something that can only take place on earth, they are no longer required to return to a physical body. In other words, the further back one goes, only the individuality remains in focus, and their incarnations are less emphasized. Buddha is more frequently spoken of in terms of a stage or a virtue, which other Buddhas also attained over the course of their lives, than of the historical Buddha, Prince Suddhodana. By contrast, it is different in the West. We have undergone an evolution in which we do not speak of the individual who moves from incarnation to incarnation. But value is placed on the personality in Western culture. We speak of Socrates, Plato, Caesar, Goethe, Spinoza, Fichte, Raphael, and Michelangelo in their single incarnation, not as individualities passing from incarnation to incarnation. We speak of the Socrates, about one Plato, Goethe, and so on, as the particular expression each individual has found. Western culture was conditioned to emphasize the individual qualities, characterizing them afresh and ignoring what the individual undergoes over many incarnations. Now we have reached the point where we are gradually recognizing how an eternal individuality proceeds through separate lives. Now we are experiencing how humanity is striving to see what lives from personality to personality. This will entail inspiring human souls anew with light that brings understanding, and this will spread throughout human souls. The way in which individual personalities will be conceived in future and how this will transpire will be illustrated in an example. Let us turn our gaze toward a figure such as the prophet Elijah. First, one observes the prophet Elijah as himself. The primary feature concerning us is that Elijah, in a certain sense, prepared the ground for the mystery of Golgotha. He pointed toward the fact that the impetus of Yahweh, Jehovah, could only be understood and conceived of by an I or ego consciousness. He was not able to predict the full meaning of the human I, being himself at an intermediary stage of ego consciousness between Moses' idea of Jehovah and the Christian idea of Christ. In this way, the prophet Elijah appears to us as a mighty harbinger, as a forerunner of Christ's impetus, of what took place through the mystery of Golgotha. Thus he appears great and mighty to us. Let us now move on and look at another figure. From a Western standpoint, we are used to seeing him as a single individuality. Behold, John the Baptist. Western outlooks see him as a finite personality, but we learn of him as the herald of Christ himself. We know him in his life as a forerunner of Christ, as the first person to utter the words, "Change the condition of your souls, for the kingdoms of heaven are nigh," indicating wholly toward what would become the impetus of Golgotha, that in the human eye a totality, a God, could be found, that the Christ eye would ever increasingly inhabit the human eye, and that the stimulus toward this was at hand. Now, we learn through spiritual scientific knowledge that what the Bible hints at is true, that the same individuality as lived in the prophet Elijah was then living in John the Baptist, so that the one who was to be a harbinger for Christ lived as Elijah, returned as John the Baptist, and was, once again, a forerunner of Christ, as befitted those times. Now, these two figures are connected for us. Western culture goes about things differently. It goes straight to an individuality, thereby neglecting the individual personality. Looking further, we find an extraordinary figure in the Middle Ages, born as if to hint that it stands in a particular relationship with the spiritual world, on Good Friday in 1483, and who returned thither as a young man in his 37th year, one who so mightily influenced the world through what he was able to bring humanity, the figure of Raphael. He was born on Good Friday, as if to betoken his connection with the events celebrated on Good Friday. What can Western views learn from spiritual science in relation to the figure of Raphael? If we observe this figure by means of spiritual science, we can learn that he accomplished more for the spread of Christianity, for embedding interconfessional Christianity in the hearts and souls of humanity, than all theological interpretations, than all the popes and cardinals of his time. Raphael may have had in his mind's eye, EYE, what history writes about the apostles. One among the Athenians stepped forward and said, "Even the gesture is captured in the painting. You people of Athens, you have brought offerings to the gods in outer signs." But there is knowledge of a God who lives and weaves in all people. That is Christ, who went through death and arose again, thereby granting humanity the stimulus toward resurrection. Some listened to this, others found it strange. Within Raphael's soul, this became the painting we find in the Vatican, which bears the incorrect name of titled The School of Athens. It actually depicts the figure of St. Paul, teaching the Athenians the fundamental tenets of Christianity. In this, Raphael was bequeathing an image, as if heralding what transcends the denominations of Christendom. The profound meaning of this painting has met with little understanding until now, and its full significance has still not dawned on humanity. If we look at other paintings by Raphael, we would need to say, truly nothing remains of what popes and cardinals achieved for humankind in those days. Yet the effects of what Raphael attained are only now really coming to life. How little he was understood in times gone by is evident from the fact that Goethe, when in Dresden, did not even go to admire the title Sistine Madonna, because he had heard from museum officials that general opinion held that the Jesus child had something mean in his expression. the two angels in the foreground, could only have been added by some lumpen artist. The Madonna herself could not, in the form we now see it, have originated in Raphael, and must have been repainted. One can trawl through the entire art history literature of the 18th century and find barely a reference to Raphael. Even Voltaire does not mention him. And today Protestants and Catholics alike, or indeed anyone at all, can be deeply moved by Raphael's paintings. It can be appreciated how in the Sistine Madonna a great cosmic mystery exists, one that imprints itself deeply on human hearts, and one which will in future be able to take this quality further if humanity can be inspired toward an interdenominational, widely encompassing Christianity, as portrayed today through spiritual science. One will be able to build upon the experience that something as wonderfully mysterious as the Sistine Madonna has affected human souls. I have often mentioned that if you look into the eyes of a human child, you can be sure that from those eyes radiates an element that has not yet stepped through birth into existence, and which allows the depths of the human soul to gaze out. Anyone looking at the children in Raphael's Madonna paintings will see that his children's eyes radiate the divinity, mystery, superhumanity, with which all children are still connected shortly after birth. This can be seen in all Raphael's paintings except one. Just one painting cannot be described in this way, and that is the Jesus in the Sistine Madonna. Anyone looking into the child's eyes knows that far more than can be contained in one human being is looking back at one from this child. Raphael created this difference so that in this one Sistine child, something should live that is purely spiritual, foretelling Christ-like qualities. So, Raphael is a harbinger who announced the spiritual Christ and who is conceived of anew in spiritual science. Through spiritual science we learn that here again is the same individuality who lived as Elijah and John the Baptist, now living in Raphael. We also learn to understand that the world in which he was John the Baptist is resurrected in Raphael through the fact that his birthday on Good Friday implies his relationship toward the historical Christ. Here we find a third harbinger after Elijah and John the Baptist, and can understand some aspects that someone seeking more widely around questions of John the Baptist would uncover. John died a martyr's death before the advent of the event on Golgotha. At the time of the mystery of Golgotha, he experienced the red dawn at sunrise, the time of prophecies and presaging, as also the times of jubilation. But he does not accompany the time of cruel persecution and suffering. If his mood of soul is now transplanted into the personality of Raphael, can we not fathom why Raphael painted so many paintings of the Madonna and Child with such devotion? Do we not understand why we find no paintings of the betrayal of Judas, no bearing of the cross, no Golgotha, no Mount of Olives? Such paintings as exist of these subjects must have been painted to order, and the being of Raphael is not truly expressed in them. Why do such images not reside within Raphael? Because as John the Baptist, he was not present to accompany the mystery of Golgotha. If you view the figure of Raphael in this light, as an individual who has existed for many centuries and still lives today, and turn your gaze to all the works that still survive, and those already destroyed, while considering that all this must go the way of all matter, one knows full well that what is alive in these paintings will be taken up into human souls long before they pass away. There will be reproductions for many centuries ahead, but what can only convey an image of Raphael's true personality, what he himself created, that will fade, will turn to dust, and his works will pass away. And nothing temporal, nothing on our earth is capable of preventing that. Yet through spiritual science, we can be certain that what lives in Raphael as an individual, all that has been worked upon, reappears in that individual together with what has been transmuted. When we learn that this same personality re-emerges as the poet Novalis, when we first hear Novalis announced, appearing like a roseate dawn as a new living idea of Christ, then we can reflect. Long before all that Raphael created and attained disappears from the world, here there reappears the individuality within this person, now in a new form, to endow humanity with all that it is capable of giving. How good it was that Western culture could only view the limited personality for a while, that we learned to love a personality purely in terms of their single life. How immeasurably are our souls enriched in the knowledge that what is eternal in human beings journeys from life to life. However differing these personalities appear to us, we will nevertheless come to understand much through what spiritual science can teach us, with concrete facts of reincarnation and karma. Humanity will benefit greatly, not so much from general concepts and doctrines as from all that can shine light on individuals. Only through intuitive vision and occult research can aspects such as these be added to what is known. And then we will be able to direct our gaze toward the mystery of Golgotha itself, remembering that in Jesus of Nazareth's 30th year, the Christ being entered him and underwent the mystery of Golgotha. If one speaks today of the fact that the Christ being cannot be embodied again in human corporeality, one must state that this has never actually been claimed, because even then his physical body was merely the sheath provided by Jesus of Nazareth, into which the spiritual Christ being was able to descend. This is not like other human beings who build their own bodies, but it was only later that the Christ being sank down into the body which Jesus of Nazareth had prepared, albeit blending entirely with it. Here too we can hardly speak of a corporeal embodiment of Christ. These are matters that are obvious to those who know about them. Now, we are aware that through this Christ impetus, something appeared on earth which flowed into humanity, which benefited all humanity by streaming into all human cultures. Thus the being who went through death is like a grain of corn, which increases, entering into individual human souls and bearing fruit. Now that we know that the Christ being, who underwent death and was immersed in the earth, was absorbed into the body of Jesus of Nazareth, we can ask ourselves, what will happen when earth has reached its goal, has come to its end? Christ, who approached the earth from far distant regions and united himself with the earth, will become the essence itself of earth's goal, will become the spirit of the earth. He is already the spirit of the earth, but in future human souls will be permeated by his being and will form a whole, a totality with his being. Now, let us frame another question. We have learned to view human beings in their earthly guise as Maya. This figure or guise, which dissolves at death, is an image or simulacrum, which appears to humans as the outer form of the human body. The outer form of the physical body does not remain, just as little as will the outer body of a plant, an animal, or a mineral remain. Physical bodies will be transformed into what atomizes and becomes cosmic dust. What one presently sees as the physical earth will have completely disappeared, will no longer exist. And as for etheric bodies, they only retain their relevance as long as physical bodies require renewal. They will also no longer be present. By the time the earth will have attained its destination, what will remain of all the humans we now see? Nothing, absolutely nothing will exist, nothing of themselves, nothing of the beings of other realms of nature. When what is spiritual will be freed, nothing will remain of material but unformed dust, because only the spirit has reality. Yet one thing, which was not previously united with earth, will have become a reality, and human souls will be united with it. One thing will be a reality, the Spirit of Christ. He will be the only real element remaining of the earth. How does this Spirit of Christ come by his spiritual sheaths? How do those sheaths, in which he will work onward, come into being? This Christ Spirit, like the soul of the earth, descended as momentum, as a force of impulsion, into the earthly sphere at the mystery of Golgotha. Even the Christ being has to form elements one can call his layers or sheaths. From whence does such a being acquire his sheaths? This does not take place in the same way as with other human beings, but Christ, too, will have a kind of spiritualized physical body, a kind of ether body, and a version of an astral body. Of what will such bodies consist? These are matters that can only be hinted at provisionally, in an interim sense. Christ descended through the baptism in the Jordan into the sheaths surrounding Jesus of Nazareth. He made use of them. He inhabited them. In them he partook of the Last Supper with his disciples. In them he experienced Gethsemane. In them he was berated and scourged. In them he underwent the mystery on Golgotha. Then he arose, was resurrected, and has lived ever since as the Spirit of the earth, united with it. He is creating something akin to the elements enveloping human beings. Gradually, over epochs of time, around the original, purely spiritual Christ impulse, which descended in the Johannine baptism, elements akin to an astral body, an ether, and a physical body are being formed. All these sheaths are formed from forces which must be developed by humanity on earth. Which forces are these? The forces of external sciences cannot build Christ a body. In them one merely learns about things which will have disappeared in future, which will no longer exist. One thing, however, advances ahead of such knowledge, and which has an endlessly greater value for souls than any knowledge in and of itself. It is what Greek philosophers saw as the origins of philosophy, awe or wonder. Once we have arrived at cognition, what is actually valuable for the soul has already passed. Those who are capable of wonder at the great events and truths of the spiritual world imbue themselves with feelings of awe and wonder. The qualities which they absorb in this way create, over time, a power which exerts a force of attraction for Christ's impetus, attracting Christ Spirit. Christ's impulse unites with individual human souls to the extent that a soul can marvel at the mysteries of the cosmos. Christ's impetus draws its astral body from all those feelings of wonder and awe alive in individual souls throughout world evolution. The second constituent needed to educate human souls, by which it draws to itself Christ's impetus, are feelings of compassion. Every time such a feeling of compassion or sympathetic joy is nurtured in the soul, it creates a force of attraction for the Christ stimulus, and Christ connects with the soul through compassion and love. Compassion and love are the forces out of which Christ forms his ether body, and will do so until the end of earth evolution. In relation to compassion and love, one could mention an agenda, to put it coarsely, which spiritual science needs to deliver in future. Materialism has diminished science to a shameful matter, even in this area, something that has never before happened on earth. The most appalling outcome of this is to conflate love with sexuality. It is the most terrible expression of materialism, the most diabolic of our times. What takes place in this quarter needs to be crystallized out. Sexuality and love, in their true senses, have nothing in common. Sexuality can be an adjunct to love, but has absolutely nothing to do with pure, pristine love. Science has caused an outrageous disgrace in publishing swathes of literature combining these two behaviors, which are totally disparate. A third trait, attracted into human souls, as if from spiritual worlds, is conscience, to which it submits and to which it ascribes a higher value than to its own individual moral instincts. Christ unites most inwardly with conscience, and from conscience does Christ derive his physical body. A saying in the Bible becomes very real for us once we know that Christ derives his life or ether body out of human feelings of compassion and love. Quote, "What you have done for the least of my brethren, you have done for me," close quote, because Christ is forming his ether body out of human compassion and love until the end of earth evolution. How Christ creates his astral body out of wonder and awe, and how he shapes his physical body from out of human conscience, in just such a way does he build his ether body out of feelings of compassion and of love. Why is it that we can now say such things? Because now one great problem will be solved for humanity, namely portraying in its reality the figure of Christ in the most varied quarters in life. This will only be seen as it really is once we have taken into account what spiritual science has to say. We should not look backward to Palestine. There the Christ availed himself of the sheaths of Jesus of Nazareth. If you immerse yourself over a long time in the spiritual scientific conception of Christ and try to depict Christ, you will arrive at a figure in the nature of whose countenance you recognize all the qualities toward which art can aim, must aim, and will aim. His countenance will contain an expression of forces victorious over all other forces in the human form. Once humans are able to form an eye, E-Y-E, that is alive and radiating pure compassion, a mouth not made for eating, but for speaking only such words of truth as issue from human tongues of conscience, and if a brow can be imagined, which is not just high and beautiful, but whose contours express clear beauty in the way it tautens forward toward what we call the lotus flower between the brows. If all this could be created, one would understand why the prophet said, "He is without form, and what is beautiful." This does not mean without beauty, but it denotes that which triumphs over decay, the figure of Christ consisting solely of compassion, of love, and the moral imperative of conscience. In this way can spiritual science serve as a seed that is planted into human feeling, into human sensing. All the teachings that spiritual science is able to share do not just remain static, but are transformed directly into life within human souls. The fruits of spiritual science will eventually become conditions of life, manifesting in souls as if they are external embodiments of spiritual knowledge itself, over the course of future human evolution, as it is destined to become. It is with thoughts such as these that I hope to have put something to work that can be effective in your souls, not merely with dry words, but when one would like to speak with feeling ideas, with nuances of feeling, to those striving for spiritual knowledge, so that these nuanced feelings and ideas can live and work, so that they can exist out there, in amongst the world. If nuanced feeling can live in hearts, it can become a fount of warmth, which can stream outward into humanity. And those who believe in this will also believe in the effect of their good feelings, will believe that every soul can feel in this way, even if karma does not allot to them the means of expressing this outwardly, and also engender invisible effects, so that what needs to come into the world through spiritual science can really be brought about. This is what I so dearly wished to elicit from you as a feeling on the occasion of my present visit to Cologne. The end of Lecture 10.